March 25th, 1945. Palm Sunday. No chances of going to a church, but still our prayers are holding everyone up. This day, it reminded me of the hundreds of people attending Mass at the cathedral in Durango, Mexico. I wish I could be there now.
From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In October of 2010, a man in his late 80s walked into the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., and registered as a Holocaust survivor. His name is Anthony Acevedo, and he walked in with items including a Red Cross armband, a Catholic prayer book, and most importantly, a tattered war diary with the pages still intact. Anthony was one of 350 American soldiers who were imprisoned inside a Nazi concentration camp during World War II, and then kept it a secret. In today's episode, the story of Anthony Acevedo, the only Mexican-American to register as a Holocaust survivor at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. Throughout the story, you'll hear Anthony in his own words through an oral history that he recorded with the Holocaust Museum in 2010. You'll also hear excerpts from his diary, which are read by an actor. Producer Janice Yamoka brings us this story now.
Anthony Acevedo grew up in a Mexican household in Pasadena, California, east of Los Angeles. And much of his childhood was pretty typical of the time. He played with his cousins, went to school, attended church. But then one day in the mid-1930s, when Anthony was almost 10 years old, he noticed that all his family's furniture had been packed up. So he asked his mom what was going on.
What's happened? Where are you going? He said, no, we're all going. And he says, where are we going? He says, we're going to Mexico. And I said, why? He said, because we were told to leave the United States.
Anthony himself had been born in the U.S., but his parents, they were undocumented. And at the time, many Mexican-American families were being pressured to leave the U.S. in something known as the Mexican repatriation. In the 1930s, Mexicans were the largest and most recent immigrant group to settle in the U.S., and following the Great Depression, they were scapegoats for the economic downturn. Historians say that somewhere between 500,000 and 2 million immigrants, as well as U.S. citizens like Anthony, were forced out of the country. So Anthony and his family moved south to Mexico, to the state of Durango.
Oh, they call me the gringo because I was born in the United States and I know half English and half Spanish. And that was kind of difficult.
But Anthony gets by, adapts, grows up, and then World War II starts. And right at the end of 1941, Japanese forces attack Pearl Harbor. And the United States enters the war.
No matter how long it may take us, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
By this point, Anthony is 17, and all of a sudden, the U.S. is trying to enlist any men of fighting age, including Anthony, even though he'd been repatriated to Mexico.
The Consul General of the United States was after me because of my age and getting ready to go back to the United States and serve your country. Yes, sir.
He was drafted. So he packed his bags, said goodbye to his family, and headed back to the U.S. to answer the call. He went to California and was trained to be an Army medic. And then, in the fall of 1944, he was sent to Europe.
To meet the German drive, General Eisenhower, here at Supreme Headquarters, resourcefully regroups his forces.
He and a group of soldiers he was with took a train to a small town in Germany called Philippsburg. By this time, it was late December of a really hard winter. And when they got out of the train, snow was waist-deep in some places. A few miles away, the Battle of the Bulge was underway. It was the Germans' last major offensive of the war. It was difficult for Anthony to find the wounded. There were bullets buzzing through the air, and the calls of medic, medic were lost in the echoes of the fighting taking place in the forest. But he found some of the injured soldiers, and one by one, he tried to help them.
I was doing repair jobs, first aid, sutures, and sewing thumbs, cutting a leg off and putting a tourniquet and sewing up the leg, the stump, doing this and that as a medic.
The battle lasted for days, until finally, Anthony's unit ran out of ammunition. The Americans began destroying everything, equipment, firearms, anything that the Nazis could use against them. And they decided it was time to surrender. So a scout walked out and waved a white flag. It was January 6, 1945. Anthony and thousands of other American soldiers were taken to a prison camp known as Stalag 9B in Bad Orb, Germany. The prisoners were referred to by numbers instead of their names. Anthony was 27016. Then, on February 8th, all the soldiers were commanded to line up.
And the commander said, all American Jews with names Jewish, take two steps forward.
Anthony says that at that point, people who had any markers of their Jewish faith, little star medals, or dog tags with an H written on them for Hebrew, desperately began to try to get rid of him, but to no avail. That day, the Nazis selected about 90 Jewish soldiers and another 260 soldiers labeled undesirables, men who they simply thought looked Jewish, considered troublemakers, or any type of other. This included 20-year-old Anthony. It could have been because he was brown-skinned or because he was Catholic, or they saw him as a troublemaker. We don't know for sure. They didn't need a reason. The following day, the Nazis put the undesirables on a train, a boxcar.
You couldn't kneel, you couldn't squat for 6 days in those boxcars. Fellas couldn't defecate at all. They had to do it right there. And for 6 days, you couldn't eat nothing. You couldn't have nothing to eat, nothing to drink. But the snow that hit the from the cracks, you try to lick it or poke your hand through the rear slot window to get drops of water from the rain.
Eventually, they arrived at a concentration camp known as Berge. It was a subcamp of Buchenwald, one of the largest Nazi concentration camps.
It was so snowy that you couldn't catch the glimpse very well, but you see towers of houses.
The men were divided into groups of 60 to 80 men per barrack. There were other prisoners in the camp as well, mainly European Jews, but they were separated from the American prisoners. The captured soldiers were forced to work in the camp. Many were put to work digging tunnels for underground fuel factories the Nazis were working on. Since Anthony was one of just a few medics in the camp, he was tasked with trying to keep the men alive as they worked. One day, the men were given a rare Red Cross package, and in it, a couple of empty journals. So Anthony took one and began writing, in secret. He sketched the places and the scenes he witnessed. He even sketched a couple of pinup girls. And to keep the diary safe, he tucked it under his belt.
March 20th, 1945. Yesterday, our planes dropped leaflets as well as bombs. Six men were sent to a British hospital. Five more men escaped today. Goldstein's body was returned here today for burial. He was shot while attempting to re-escape, so they say, but actually was recaptured and shot through the head.
Anthony's diary became a record of daily life in the camp.
March 22, 1945. Private Schultz died of malnutrition. This is the fourth man to die. The weather is beautiful, and it looks like spring, which has finally come to Germany. By this time back home, I'd be suffering from hay fever.
We got 100 grams of bread per week. 100 grams of bread is not much. It was a mixed of barley with sawdust, ground glass, and ground sand.
March 25th, 1945. Palm Sunday. No chances of going to a church, but still our prayers are holding everyone up. This day, it reminded me of the hundreds of people attending Mass at the cathedral in Durango, Mexico. I wish I could be there now. March 30th, 1945. Good Friday. On this holy day, our thoughts are all at home and of the coming Easter Sunday. It is also the feast of the Passover for our Jewish comrades, and they also think of home and family.
As the journal entries went on, the more Anthony wrote about the horrors in Berga, men from his unit began to die in greater numbers, from malnutrition or beatings or being overworked.
April 2nd, 1945. Two more of our men died today, and one last night. Makes 3 plus 16 makes 19. Living in unsanitary conditions, water must be boiled before it is drunk. No latrines. Deaths are increasing in great number. Men forced to work in the mine whether they are ill or not.
Sometimes Anthony simply recorded deaths.
Rogers, March 9th, 1945. Young, March 12th, 1945. Goldstein, March 10th, 1945. Goldberg, March 25th, 19th.
I knew that maybe someday it would be a valuable thing for us to know that that was important. I had a fountain pen with me that I was writing all the time with. And I don't know how God gave me that ink to last.
Coming up on Latino USA, American forces inch closer to defeating the Nazis and liberating the men at Berga.
Received very good news today. The Americans are 250 kilometers from here and moving fast.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, we're back. And when we left off, 20-year-old Anthony Acevedo was documenting his daily life as a prisoner inside a Nazi concentration camp known as Berga. Producer Janice Yamoga picks up this story now.
But it's emphasized here at Shade that the next few days will be spent building up our forces east of the Rhine.
By April, U.S. troops had successfully crossed the Rhine River, one step closer to defeating Germany.
While British and American troops were crossing the Rhine north of the Ruhr, the last German resistance west of the Rhine collapsed.
They were nearing Berga, and Anthony and his fellow prisoners were hearing rumors.
Received very good news today. The Americans are 250 kilometers from here and moving fast. Received good news. Americans are only 200 kilometers away from here, which means they are excellent news today. Americans are only 100 kilometers from here. Said that our boys were 60 kilometers from us.
The Nazis evacuated the subcamp and forced the remaining soldiers on a death march that would last 3 weeks and over 200 miles.
April 9th, 1945. We marched 10 kilometers today. We're supposed to go to the town of Hof, but we arrived to a big barn, for our air corps were bombing that town continuously. We started out with 304 men from Berga. We now have 287 men.
Many of the men died on the march. Their bodies were left by the side of the road.
Stewart, April 5th, 1945. Vogel, April 9th, 1945.
Weeks went by. Maxwell, then suddenly, April very 5th, early in the morning, 19th. The men heard firing. Like thunder in the distance. The American tanks were getting closer. The Nazis wanted to continue marching and threatened the men that they'd shoot them if they didn't continue. But Anthony and another medic stood their ground, and the Nazis, afraid of the advancing troops, fled.
We started to hear the rumbling getting closer, and then we all started to run towards the highway.
When they got to the highway, they found the 11th Armored Division. The men were finally free again.
We were liberated today, April the 23rd, 1945.
Out of 350 American soldiers, about half of the men survived Berga, and many of the remaining men were close to death. When Anthony was first captured, he weighed 149 pounds. By the time he was set free, he weighed 87. The surviving men, including Anthony, were taken to hospitals, and by June, they were on their way back home to the U.S. But there was one condition, one that the former captives didn't quite understand.
We had to sign an affidavit where we had to swear that we never were in the condition or suffered in the condition that we had gone through by the Germans.
The war was still going on, and the U.S. military wanted to keep exactly what went on inside the Nazi prison camps a secret, since they had soldiers being held as prisoners of war and believed information getting out could put them at risk. So men like Anthony were told they had to sign this document.
They threatened us to be jailed federally by the United States government.
But national security or not, for the men who survived Berga, it felt like they were being told to keep their trauma a secret, like they didn't have a choice. So Anthony signed the document, and for years, he didn't talk much about what he saw in Berga. After the war, Anthony went back to Mexico, then settled in California. He got married, and he started a family. And he worked as an engineer in the aerospace industry for many years. Here's his son, Fernando Acevedo.
I just remember sitting at the table, and it was being, you know, a kid that's real picky about what they're eating. And I just remember my dad stating, when I would leave the edges of the bread, when I was a prisoner of war, that's all I had to eat. And that just stuck with me.
Fernando is one of Anthony's four children, and he says his father did a pretty good job of hiding what he'd been through.
If you look at my dad in those years, you could not tell he had gone through anything that was in extreme in nature because, I mean, he hid his PTSD so well.
Still, it was impossible to hide everything.
Well, my dad would just take off. He'd be gone. I don't know where he went. And then I'd hear my mom go out there and it's like, where everybody go? And then I'd see you out there and I hear my dad crying. I would see my mom massaging the back of his head and I would ask, you know, what's wrong with Poppy? And she would say he's going through something traumatic. And then my dad would say, I'll be okay. I'll be okay. And that happened often.
Fernando also remembers how at home, his father always kept his war diary on the nightstand. It was small and greenish-gray, with a red outline of a lion, and the words, a wartime log, on the cover. It was worn, a little beat up, like it belonged inside a glass case in some museum.
He had it at the nightstand at the end of the hallway, and it was just sitting there.
For Fernando and his siblings, it was just an old book, filled with his father's handwriting, some sketches, and a few empty pages.
Even our older brother kind of doodled in the back with crayons. Thankfully, we didn't mess up all the really important pages. It was in the back where there was just blank pages.
And for a long time, the diary just sat there on the nightstand, holding Anthony's secrets within its yellowed pages. As an adult, Fernando took a job at the same company as his father. And eventually, during their long commutes, his dad told him the story about what he went through, about World War II, about getting captured, about Berga. But since the story of the soldiers at Berga hadn't been officially recognized by the U.S. Army, even though Anthony had started to talk about it here and there, with people at work or at the Veterans Hospital, many didn't believe him.
Throughout my years, I do remember my father telling me, you know, he would shake his head and he felt very hurt. He was very hurt. Even the amount and the extremeness of his PTSD, people would even question that.
Fernando knew his father's story needed to be told and wanted to share it on a larger scale. In 2006, he reached out to CNN. And 2 years later, his father did a public interview.
I says, I can't believe this. Nobody knows about us.
At 84, Acevedo shares the diary no one was supposed to see.
Two more of our men died today, and one lost last night. Makes three.
As a result, one man named Martin Vogel found out what happened to his brother Jack, who was in Berga with Anthony, and died there.
My brother was a year and a half older than I was, but we were very, very close. He had finished 2 years of college. The draft board called him and said, your name has come up. You have to go into the Army. And by the time I was 18, I went into the Army. And when I came home, they told me that my brother had died in a prisoner of war camp.
Today, Martin is 92 years old. And for 63 years, he'd had no idea what happened to his brother. But when he read that CNN article, he saw that Anthony wrote his brother's name in his diary as one of the deaths in Berga.
Vogel, April 9th, 1945.
It was the first time after years of searching that he finally learned about his brother's final moments. His brother had died in Anthony's arms. Martin still finds it hard to talk about his brother.
It brings back memories. After all, we only lived together. He was 19 when he went into the service, and we had only 19 years together. So it wasn't that long, but we had a wonderful relationship. Just talking about it now, I find it difficult to continue a coherent conversation because I get so upset.
Anthony's diary also caught the attention of Kira Schuster, a curator at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, who reached out to him.
And that was a big part of why I did reach out to them, was because I wanted to see if maybe we could acquire his diary for our permanent collection, because at that point, we had no original artifacts in our permanent collection from the Berga camp.
In 2010, Anthony and his family visited Washington, D.C., and he formally donated the items he saved from his captivity. A Red Cross armband, a small palm cross, a Catholic prayer book, some personal photographs, and most importantly, his diary. The museum has more than 200 diaries in its collection, but this diary, it was the first written by an American-born survivor of a concentration camp.
I speak for all my buddies that were there. And I do this with honor. I turn this over to the Holocaust Museum.
Kira says the donation received quite a bit of press and led to many other survivors of Berga or their families also donating materials, including three other diaries from the camp. During his visit, Kira introduced Anthony to a Holocaust survivor who was a volunteer at the museum.
And so I introduced the two of them, and he was so taken aback and surprised, and he looked at me and he was like, thank you so much for introducing me to her. I've never met a Holocaust survivor before. And I said, but you're a Holocaust survivor.
But until that moment, he never thought of it that way. It's a sensitive topic, who should be considered a Holocaust survivor and who isn't. So many suffered during the war. But the prisoners of war held at the Berger concentration camp were used as slave laborers, and their living conditions were so horrific that scholars consider them survivors of the Holocaust. Anthony registered as a Holocaust survivor in 2010.
And I can confirm Tony was the first Mexican-American Catholic Holocaust survivor to register with the museum.
Anthony Acevedo died this year, on February 11th, 2018. He was 93. Before Anthony shared his story in a big way, he visited a local school in California and spoke to a group of junior high students about his experience in a Nazi concentration camp. It was one of the first times he shared his story, and he was taken aback that the students, they didn't really know anything about the soldiers held at Berger.
You see tears coming down. It affects them. But they all say, why didn't my father tell me about this? And why did my grandma didn't tell me about this? Why didn't the school tell us about this?
Anthony's own story came close to not being included in this history. Until, with the help of a little gray-green diary and a fountain pen, he wrote himself in.
In 2009, a year after Anthony did a public interview with CNN, the U.S. Army finally recognized the 350 soldiers held as prisoners at Berger. 64 years later, Anthony is survived by his four children and six grandchildren. This episode was reported by Janice Yamoca and edited by Annie Aviles. The Latino USA team includes Fernanda Chavarri, Andres Caballero, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, and Sayer Quevedo. Production help this week from Ashley Cleek. Our senior editor is Marlon Bishop. Fact-checking by Zoe Malik. Our engineers and music editors are Ginny Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our senior production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Maya Cueva and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our intern is Reese Williams. We had help this week from Samuel Kreger and Ugly Duck Studios in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. Special thanks to Brandon Gomez and the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next time, and in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at heisingsimons.org. Winecoat Foundation. And funding for Latino USA's coverage of A Culture of Health is made possible in part by a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, a cultural icon and her song that became a definitive pride anthem in Espanol. Alaska, the singer, not the state. That's next time on Latino USA.
Summer long, Pop Culture Happy Hour can help you find the best stuff, big and small. Summer is blockbuster and indie movie season. It's TV discovery season. It's beach chair binge watching season. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get podcasts.